Okay, hello and a warm welcome back to Wind Your Neck In. And as always, I'm your host, Niall Amott. I think this is a small apology out first, probably, as Floyd and I are having a chat there. I have to apologize that we've been a couple of weeks since our last episode. We thankfully and very, very happily welcomed our first daughter to the world, Floyd. So there's been a couple of weeks. I'm sure the listenership won't hold it against me too much, but we have a couple of weeks since our last episode and we are over the moon to be back. And what a really kind of special and powerful episode we've got coming your direction. This week on episode 4 of Wind Your Neck, and we're welcoming Floyd Steadman to the show, and a name that will be very popular at the current moment in terms of some of the coverage that you've had, Floyd, in and around Sky News, and some really important pieces coming out in some pretty, I don't want to name them, high-end profile newspapers. And it all sits around the massive news that you've released a book very recently, which is A Week One Summer, Floyd Steadman's story. So, Floyd, first of all, it's an absolute honor to have you on. I really appreciate you taking your time. How is everything going with you?
Well, first thing I need to say is thank you for inviting me on, Niall. And secondly, congratulations on being a father.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'll tell you what, it's been an amazing 14, 15 days, but there's no instruction manual. So we're very much making this up as we go along.
And quite right too. I've got three grown-up sons now, and as a teacher, what works for one family, it's not going to work for another family. So just do it the way that you think is appropriate.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thank you very much. I think we're settling in very well. Mum's well, and we're glad to be back, kind of getting into that normal rhythm of stuff. So, it's great to have you on. I think the context of where this conversation is probably going to go will sit around, largely around the kind of story that you've released, and it's a very. I was just telling you there, Floyd, that I was lucky to get a sneak peek at the episode as I was sat in hospital for a week waiting for Lottie to arrive. And it was fantastic. And I did say this to you off air because I didn't want it to seem disingenuous and untruthful, but I promise you it was such a powerful read. I suppose in your world, it's probably been a very busy couple of weeks. What has it looked like since the book launch?
Oh my gosh, it's been crazy, but it's been crazy in a good way. And I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think now one of the things that I was anxious about is that I knew that I was sort of laying my life out there. People that know me know that I'm quite a private person, and I'm talking about things that happened 50 plus years ago, things that are incredibly difficult, still very, very painful memories. But I'm doing this because first and foremost, my wife has always said to me, Floyd, you need to write a book. She's one of the only people now that really knew the story. People knew snippets here and there, but my wife Denise knew the whole story. As you probably know, I lost her to cancer 5 years ago. But certainly 15 or so years ago, she said, Floyd, you need to write a book. People need to know your story. It's an inspiring story. And that really planted a seed for me. And the last 2 weeks, you know, since the release, we've had the Sunday Times do a wonderful article on me. Radio 5 Live, Rachel Burden interviewed me and Mauro Atoji. I'm sure you'll talk about Mauro. The Sky documentary came out. I've got you, which is wonderful, to do the podcast with you.
A different level, but yeah, we're happy to be in there.
Oh, I'm delighted that you're in there. I'm going to the Saris game against London Irish on Saturday. Fantastic. To promote the book and to sign, do book sign-ins. And next Monday, the big one, because I've relocated to Cornwall. So I've got Radio Cornwall interviewing me next Monday.
Fantastic. Cornwall's such an amazing part of the world. Somewhere like being Irish, we love the sea, obviously. I feel very landlocked here in Worcester. So an amazing place to live. You're enjoying being down there, eating the fresh fish every day.
Love it. And, you know, my wife was Cornish. She's from a very large Cornish family. So I'm down here with a lot of family and one or two good friends as well.
Fantastic. Yeah, I was. I'm terribly sorry to hear about your loss with your wife. It sounds like there was a massive inspiration, like you mentioned, to do something quite uncomfortable and lay yourself out there. I think anyone who reads it will be very glad you did. And I'm glad that you kind of took and followed on from the seed that was planted by your wife. I think if we look to the start, I think, you know, one of the things that I felt, and I just spoke to you about it, Floyd, was the reason I liked the book so much was because it did make me feel uncomfortable at times. And I think that was something which happened in a really natural way. There was no victim mindset around the way this book was written. It was very much, you laid it out there and it is uncomfortable because of what you had to go through. Throughout the process of writing the book, was it therapeutic or was there some really challenging moments?
Incredibly painful, but also, Niall, incredibly therapeutic. You know, the challenging moments were sort of trying to remember what happened when I was a child 50 plus years ago.
Yeah.
And dragging up memories that I thought that I'd locked away forever. Yeah. Memories like, Niall, you know, I ran away from home for the best part of 3 weeks. And when I gave myself in and the policeman and the social worker, you know, were on my front door, and my father opened the door and refused to allow me back in the house. You are now a parent. I'm a parent to three grown-up sons. It just doesn't compute with me how a parent, whatever their child has done, can say, I don't want you back. And memories like that I'd locked away and obviously had to drag them up. And of course, then more recently, 5 years ago, losing my wife and talking honestly about that process as well. But it's a cathartic process. It's part of the whole process, particularly in terms of bereavement, that we all have to go through. At the start of my bereavement process, I thought, I'm an ex-rugby player, I can cope. I don't need to do it properly. Well, actually, we do it differently, but we have to do it properly.
I completely agree, and I would endorse that message massively. I mean, it's no secret for the people who have listened to or serial listeners of the podcast, something very similar through my career whenever I lost my father to cancer, and the ability for me to deal with, I threw myself into a rehab of an injury. And it's great to hear that, you know, the process of actually opening up, which we're not, can be renowned for not being very good at, Floyd, helped. And I think I'm glad to hear the process of writing it really did kind of find some ease with kind of some of the subjects. I wonder, how long did it take probably for you to shape the story?
Well, the story, Niall, was always there. It was a matter of thinking, you know, how am I going to pull it together? How am I going to write it down? And in the end, I decided that I wanted to be honest and matter of fact. I didn't want to shock people, but I wanted to take people out of their comfort zone because they need to know the facts of what happened to me as a 10-year-old boy.
Yeah. I wonder, how does a 10-year-old boy survive on the streets, though? Like, I mean, I was thinking about this, and at 10, I certainly wasn't ready to go and live on the streets. I mean, you, for whatever reason, it seems like such a tender age to be taken out and faced with this kind of find somewhere to sleep, find something to eat. And when I read it, it made me feel very uncomfortable, which I suppose it was the desired effect. I mean, what sort of, for the people who haven't read it yet, whilst I'm not expecting you to narrate the whole book, because we want people to go out there and buy it, what sort of challenges did you face as a 10-year-old living on the streets?
Well, you know, the fact that I ran away from home without really thinking about it, I was locked in my room once again for, I've got no idea what I did wrong. It was almost certainly not that bad, but obviously my father, who was very old-fashioned and gave out now what he would term as good old-fashioned West Indian discipline. Now, I'm a headmaster. I know it is physical abuse, emotional abuse, neglect. I've got scars on the body skill. And when I decided to take off, I didn't plan it. I literally opened the window, climbed down the drain pipe, jumped over the back fence, and I ran away. And then once I ran away, I had no money, I had no food, and I think, what am I going to do next? And I was making it up as I went along, and I was very, very lucky. And you know, Niall, as a headmaster in a prep school, I, a lot of the time, have got children that are sort of 9, 10, 11 years old. And when I was pulling this book together, I was looking at these 10-year-olds thinking, how did I do it? How did I stay alive? How did I not get picked up by the wrong type of person?
Yeah.
I can't answer that. I was clearly very, very lucky.
Yeah, it's a terrifying thought. I suppose things in the house, without delving into the real details too much, like, they must have been so bad that you felt that was the only choice you had.
Yeah, I mean, they were shocking. You know, I cannot put it more bluntly than that. They were absolutely shocking. The things that my father did to me, my sister, to his first wife, when I was even younger. And again, I don't want to do any spoiler alerts, but he drove her out, and he made sure that she didn't contest me and my sister. It was absolutely appalling. And you see, when you're a young child and you go to school, you go to primary school and you listen to your friends and what they're doing in school and at home, and you compare that to what you're doing at home, and you think, hang on a minute, something's not quite right. And you understand. Now, I'm trying to rationalize it, Niall, by saying that my father was one of the Windrush generation. They came over from all over the Commonwealth. My parents came over from Jamaica. And they came from an existence that in a very small community in the heart of Jamaica, and they had nothing. My grandfather was a laborer on a very small plot of land. My grandmother was a maid. They lived in a shack with no facilities, no electricity. They were very, very poor. And my parents left that because they wanted a better life. But they also left that now because the United Kingdom invited people from the Commonwealth to the UK after the Second World War to help rebuild the motherland. And they thought they were coming to something better. And once they got here, the racism, the abuse, and so it was incredibly difficult. Another thing, and I'm doing my best not to defend my father, but my grandfather died when my father was 3 years old. Mm. So he didn't have that positive male role model. He didn't have an education, and life was very, very hard for him.
Yeah, yeah, I can see the balance that you're trying to go with there, and I'm sure it's very, very difficult. I suppose the point at which you've mentioned, you know, ended up back on the doorstep once you'd finally maybe had enough, or I know how you put it in the book, and we're so conscious of spoilers. And when you'd had enough, or decided that you were going to go and speak to someone that you trusted. When he said he didn't want you in the house after everything you'd been through, a shockingly difficult time for you, what was the next stage of where you ended up and what you went through?
So the next stage was I was taken into care. I was a looked after child, taken into care.
The term looked after child, I mean, that's, with all due respect, it's like a dated term, but like what would you describe, explains a looked after child?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question for me. So a looked after child is someone that's not living with their parents. They're either in a foster home or they're in a children's home. Now, in my situation, I was in a children's home. The first one I was in a big children's home for 4 months. And it's a bit like a holding pen while the authorities are trying to decide what are they going to do with you and where you're going to eventually end up. And in this first children's home now, I got a lot of negative messaging from some of the adults that were looking after me. And they were saying things to me and the other black boys, things like, you're the dregs of society. You're going to do nothing with your life. You're going to end up in prison. You're going to end up in young offenders institution. Now, Niall, the sad thing is when you have responsible adults saying that to children, the children are going to believe a lot of that. And some of those black boys did make poor decisions and did get into trouble. But we shouldn't be surprised because that's what the adults were basically telling them to do.
Yeah, it was almost like a positive enforcement, you know, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the expectation is, well, because of the color of your skin, you will behave this way. And actually, they're actually directing people to behave that way. Now, I don't know, because people keep asking me, so why didn't you behave that way? Why didn't you go down the wrong route? I don't have an easy answer. I think I've always been driven and motivated. I think from a young age, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. And to get there, I needed an education, which meant I had to work hard at school.
So, I mean, it's a brilliant opportunity for us to kind of J-line to that that education that you did get. So, I mean, there is obviously an innate drive for you to make success of yourself in some way. The education, did it come easy or did you have to work harder than everybody else?
It didn't come easy. I mean, I went to a very large school, Kingsbury High School. Mm. Now, Kingsbury High School was the amalgamation of two schools, the joining together of two schools. Kingsbury County Grammar School, a very academic school, and Tyler's Croft Secondary Modern School. Because, you know, I was a child on the cusp when it was moving from the tripartite system of grammar schools, secondary modern schools and tertiary schools onto the comprehensive model, the all-in, wherever your ability, you're in the comprehensive school together. So I passed my 11 plus. My last year in primary school, I was told that I did very well. And I went to this very large comprehensive school, Kingsbury High School, and there were 12 streams in a year now. And it was from 1A, the brightest students, to 1L. And those poor students in 1L, and people of my age, Neil, will remember this, they were termed, wait for this, the ESN students. ESN stands for Educationally Subnormal.
Wow.
In education, we were terming children educationally subnormal. And now, lo and behold, there was a higher proportion than there should have been of black and brown students in those ESM classes.
I mean, the question is, did they deserve to be there, or were they put there because of the colour of their skin?
We don't know the answer, but my assumption is that for many, they were there because of the colour of their skin, and because of the colour of their skin, people were assuming that they wouldn't be as intelligent.
Yeah.
I know we're going to get on to rugby, and I've got one or two little anecdotes when we get on to the rugby in terms of me and my journey. But back to the school and getting in. So there was 12 streams. I was put in E. It was A, B, C, D, E. So E was the fifth stream down. Yep. The top five streams were the old O-level streams. But if you're in the bottom of the O-level, you didn't know whether you're going to do the O-level or the CSE that was. And I kept pushing back with my teachers because all of my friends were in ABC. And I kept pushing back very politely. And eventually they allowed me to do mainly O-levels with a few CSEs. Now, what that meant, Niall, is that I rejoined a lot of my old primary school friends that were doing the O-levels. But you see, I think there was a downside. And I say this to people, from my point of view, 3 years of my education were wasted. Three years where I wanted to be challenged and motivated. And my teachers were saying things like, oh, Floyd, you're good at sport, stick to the sport. Or don't go down the academic route, do something with your hands. And you have to keep pushing back against that. Now, why were they saying that? And you will hear me say this a lot of the time. People made assumptions about me based on one thing alone, and that was the colour of my skin.
Yeah, and I suppose... Well, there's so many questions formulating in my head. I think one of the things I probably would be interested to know was in that early childhood, before we move into the rugby, was like what some of the experiences you went through in a less kind of, how would you describe it? I suppose there's like a conscious and unconscious racism that lives in society, isn't there? And some of those you could easily describe as like an unconscious racism towards people of whatever color. What sort of indications in your life did you have where there were more conscious choices for them to decide that you shouldn't do stuff or couldn't do stuff? Incidents that kind of stand in your mind where you automatically remember thinking that this is wrong?
Well, I do a lot of lecturing on unconscious bias. And so we can touch on that later. But when I was a child, the conscious bias, i.e. the racism, were things like what those adults were saying in the children's home.
Yeah.
That's racist attitude in terms of what they were saying.
Yeah.
Or some of the language that was aimed at me and other black and brown students. That is racism. So you've got that, but you've then also got the unconscious bias. And I saw the unconscious bias on a daily basis. Things like, let me give you a couple of quick examples of unconscious bias. Why was I put in the fifth set from the top when most of my friends were in the top two or three? I did well in my 11 plus. I was put there because of unconscious bias, where people were feeling that black and brown skinned children weren't as bright, weren't as intelligent, so can't be higher at the top end of the school. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. It's almost like they've already decided you don't have the capacity, which is exactly why it's unconscious. Yeah, and I think that's kind of, it's the underbelly of racism, isn't it? It's actually, and again, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I know or understand, but direct and hurtful racism is an awful thing. But whenever blocks, paths and careers are blocked as a result of unconscious racism, unconscious bias, that to me seems like a larger issue. And I know we'll cover on that kind of unconscious bias later, which I'm really looking forward to touching on. I think it's important for us to touch on rugby, and because, you know, at that age, you start to find rugby. You've already mentioned that you were a fantastic athlete, enjoyed sport, which was probably a release for you in some way.
Oh, sport was a huge release. I mean, I found that the challenge that I was facing in the classroom and in life in general, being in care in a children's home, you know, and going back to that when all of my friends were going back to their families, their close-knit families, listening to the stories of all the things that my friends would do at school, and obviously I didn't have the opportunity to do those. But I found that I was good at sport, any sport, you know, start off with football and then padball and you name it, I was good at it. Went to senior school, high school, and the very first games lesson, and I do remember this now, there was 300 students in the year, massive year. So there were over 2,000 plus students in the school. So there were 300 plus in the year. So there was 150 or so boys. It was a co-ed school. The first games lesson, Welsh rugby teacher, Brian Jones, lined us all up. And because this was a school with a very strong rugby tradition back in the day, but it played rugby and football every Saturday morning, so you couldn't do both. So he lined us up, and he was looking at people and pointing either to football or to rugby. and that was the selection process. And he looked at me, looked up and down, and he pointed to rugby. Now, I think, Niall, that he was very astute. But out of the 300-plus students in our year, there were about 12 of us that were black boys and girls. And most of the black boys he put to the rugby side. And there's a photo that's in the book of my under-15 team, which was unbeaten. We won everything. 15-a-side, 7-a-side, county check. We won everything. 8 white boys, 7 black boys. Now, you know, that was certainly in terms of diverse, a wonderful diverse team. But that Welsh PE teacher, Brian Jones, and sadly he's passed away, so I can't thank him in person, absolutely saved me. Because that pointed me in the direction of rugby, and I began to develop my rugby skills. And as I developed my rugby skills, doors began to open. But Niall, even then, I still had to put up with racism and unconscious bias. And let me give you another example in terms of the rugby. So, you know, going through school, I was getting better and better, then going to county trials, getting into the county team. And in my final year at school, A-level year, I was captain of my county, Middlesex. Now, what we did back in the days, we played our county fixtures through the autumn term. And then at Christmas, all the boys that were away at the independent boarding schools would come back for what they called the Christmas trials, and then would have more matches sort of in January, February, which was going towards a divisional setup. And basically, they were national trials. So I was captain of Middlesex. We had a very good team. We won most of our matches. Christmas trials, who's up against me? The captain of Harrow School, a white boy. Who gets selected for the first game when we played Eastern Counties? The captain of Harrow School. And this is back in the day when you had 2 subs and you could only make a substitution if there was an injury. Yeah. So I sat on the bench all that match, watching this guy play. I thought he wasn't as good as me. The selectors realized their mistake and they put me back in. But here's the rub. In that first game, I would have played against Nick Youngs, Ben Youngs' dad. That year, Nick Youngs played for England Schoolboys. And a lot of it was on the back of how he was doing through that structure. And because he did better than the Middlesex scrum half, he was always the number one scrum half in London division. Yeah. Now, I was then reinstated to the county, but because I never got to play against Nick Youngs, I was always his number two until I got myself injured before the final trial. So because of the selector's decision, picking that white Harrow scrum half ahead of me, I potentially missed out on the opportunity of England Schoolboys. But it's deeper than that, Niall, because, of course, there was me, black boy, and a generation ago, the black boys were wingers and centres. You know, I still talk about Andy Harriman, the Prince, Chris Oche, Jerry Gusker, played with and against them all. Wonderful players. Mike Wedderburn from Sky, I've got to say him because he's a good friend.
Yeah.
Or they were the big forwards, Clint McGregor from Saracens before me, or Victor Abugu, Francis Imurua. And they were the big forwards, they were the wide, the runners, but they were never, ever the scrum half. Question for you. Can you name another English black scrum half at the top end of the game?
Well, I've done my research and I know there isn't one. is the answer. And the reason I've done my research is because I was looking into exactly this. And this is the usual conversation that, generationally has passed in America, but it's the old, you can't have a black quarterback.
I remember the first black quarterback. He played for the Washington Redskins in the mid-80s. I can't remember his name. And the huge debate around him was similar to the debate around me when I was made captain of the Saracens. And that was, you know, are we intelligent enough? Can we liaise with our teams? Can we talk to the referee? It's insulting to have that put your way.
I completely understand. And I think one of the things that stood out for me whenever this has been going on a lot longer than you'd think, because someone like Michael Vick, like I am, I'm a sport pig, right? And Michael Vick is was renowned for being a running quarterback. So his threat was not passing. Mm. It was like they would move the ball and he would basically run through because no one would mark him. So for in layman's terms, but what they developed over time was that, oh, hold on, Michael Vick's actually got a cannon, and you're already seeing examples of people being put into positions where, he can't play there for whatever reason. So when you eventually fall into the position of scrum half, what sort of age was that? Who put the trust in you to be able to do that? Because it seems like there was a blocked pathway as a result of the colour of your skin.
So I started off, you'll never believe this, I started off playing hooker.
Because
although I was small, I tackled anything that moved. And of course, Brian Jones thought, right, put him in the middle of the pack because he tackles. I then went from hooker to number 8. Mm. I was small, but I was quite mobile. I then went to fullback. Because last line of defense, Floyd will tackle them. It was the start of what we now call year 10. Mm. And our scrum half, another black boy, Eric Atkins, big, very physical, was a fantastic runner. But Brian Jones saw that he was just always running and breaking tackles, but the backs weren't getting the ball. Mm. So Brian swapped the two of us. He put me at scrum half, and I was smaller. Slighter, but Eric at fullback, suddenly that one move, the whole thing clicked into place and our team, as I said, were unbeaten.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I suppose the questions run slightly deeper as well, Floyd, because I mean, we'll get to the amazing career you had at Saris, you know, 460 plus games for a club like Saris over a period of 10 years, which is an insane stat, actually, when you think about it, and we'll get to that. But why rugby? You know, what about rugby really grabbed you as a person?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because when I was at school, I played everything. Yeah. I played rugby every Saturday morning. If there wasn't a rugby match, I played football for the school. At one point, I was trying to play club football as well as school rugby. I played basketball. I was captain of the basketball. I played badminton. I was in the county squash setup. I did trampolining, you name it. The only thing I couldn't do was swim because I sink. You know, I'm an ex-PE teacher and I teach 12 junior, you take a deep breath, you form a star or a ball and you float. When I do it, I go right to the bottom. So swimming was out, but everything else I did and I loved it. But you know, now it was the camaraderie of being part of a team. And you will understand this. You put your body on the line for your teammates and they're there for you. Yeah. And the success isn't individual success, it's the team success. And you play a small part in the team. And whenever all the parts of the team come together, you know, and you do a fantastic move or you defend well or you score a great team try, the satisfaction from that.
So I wonder, I mean, and I hope this isn't too personal a question, but the way you explain it, it almost sounds like you find a family. You know, you find like people you could depend on. You find like you had a group of people that you could rely on, especially after such a tough start to your childhood. Is that a fair comment?
I think that's spot on. Absolutely spot on. You know, it was a substitute for what I didn't have.
Yeah. And I suppose that kind of probably fueled your intent to try and stay in the game for as long as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And then as I was getting older, I was getting more successful. And, you know, the final 2 or 3 years of my school education, I was then involved in the county setup. Yeah. In my final year, I was involved in the division as well as the county. I went to the start of my final year, I went to a training camp for potential England rugby schoolboys. And that was the first time that anyone had actually talked about me potentially at an England level. And who was in charge of that camp? Big Rog, Roger Utley, who I've got to know very, very well. And, you know, when you have people like Roger Utley saying really, really nice things about you. You think, actually, you know, maybe there is a future for me in the game called rugby.
Yeah, yeah. And it is such an amazing sport, you know. What the sport gives you, I suppose, how I was taught anyway. I mean, from Northern Ireland in Belfast, the school.
Which school were you at now?
I was at Methodist College Belfast.
Because one of my best college friends was at one of the other big schools, Armagh Bremer?
Armagh, yeah. They're out in the country. Tough, tough people out there. Yeah, we used to have a couple of big old bait matches against them.
So, no, when I was at Borough Road College, our rugby coach was a Northern Irishman called John Hunter.
Right.
And he took us, 1978, in the height of the Troubles, we went out and we played Queen's Belfast.
Yeah.
And we played Armagh. And the one thing he said to us all is, you do not talk politics. For obvious reasons. You know, and we managed to until we played Armagh and we were in the clubhouse afterwards. And one of the guys said, wow, this is a really nice new clubhouse. What happened to your old one? Whoops.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm straight there. I think for the people listening, you just need to take yourself back to that period of time and why did buildings disappear?
Yeah.
I mean, listen, not talking politics is a fairly good rule just to live your life by in general, isn't it?
Definitely. Definitely. although what I'm now doing now is, you know, for a lot of my life, I probably did sit on the fence.
Yeah.
I'm finding that I've got an interesting story. I've got a voice. I've been given a platform. So I'm actually not going to sit on the fence. I'm going to try and use my voice in a wise way to influence other people in a positive way.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant way to approach it, for sure. The platform could be wasted otherwise. I think one of the things I was going to touch on there in relation to rugby is what all the behaviours and mannerisms that it teaches you, right? So there's a huge fundamental like layer of how you're supposed to conduct yourself, how you're supposed to act, how you respond to people, how the respect that you show referees, for example. So as a young man, kind of finding yourself off the back of a tough start to your life, I mean, did the sport give you tools and behaviours that obviously you needed at that stage?
There's no question. The sport gave me the tools, not just to be successful on the rugby pitch, but actually now to be successful in life.
Yeah.
You know, I was a young captain at 23 years old, speaking in front of 200-300 people at a club dinner. Yeah. And back in the bread rolls that are flying my way. And you quickly learn how to approach these things and how to speak to. One minute I'm talking to one of my teammates that could be, you know, a bricklayer or a builder. The next minute one of my teammates is a lawyer, a solicitor. Then I'm talking to a club captain or a club president. You meet so many interesting people and you learn how to deal with different people. And I think what I learned, one of the important things that I learned now was that you can't treat people the same way. And I've used the same approach to my teaching. If I'm the captain and I want to get the best out of every single one of my players, I'm not going to treat them the same. You know, there are some that I can really kick them up the backside to get them going. Others I really need to hold their hand and say, come on, we can do this. And you learn how to get the best out of your team. You actually learn how to get the best out of your committee. When you're the captain, you need your committee's support. Okay, how am I going to approach this? I mean, what's the outcome? And what's the best way that I can approach this to get the desired outcome? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes absolute sense, because they are just effectively some key fundamentals in leadership, which I would love to touch on with you, because the experience and pedigree you have in a rugby capacity and obviously in a work capacity with the teaching is something I'm very interested in. And I suppose leadership is this kind of term that's banded around and, oh, that's a great example of leadership, or, oh, I think, you know, the team lacked leadership this week. I mean, for you fundamentally, as someone who's probably led and watched particularly good leaders through your life and career, what are some key fundamentals of great leadership apart from that kind of, you've touched on one already, that kind of, you know, difference of way you treat people?
So some of the characters, I think, in true leadership, firstly, you've got to be a good listener. If you want to get the best out of your team, you've got to listen to them. Secondly, you've got to trust your team. Thirdly, you have to empower your team. There's no point picking a team and saying, right, you're doing it my way. And my team will tell you, I'll go into senior team meetings and I'll say, okay, let's discuss X or Y. And I'll say, this is what I think, but I want to hear your views. And if there was a view that was better, I said, you know, that is a brilliant idea. I don't know why I didn't think of that. We're going to do that. And I would make sure that they knew that I was taking on board their idea. Because another important thing about leadership is succession planning. I'm not going to be around forever, whether I'm going to be the captain or the headmaster. And you need people coming up behind. You don't want to keep them down. You want them to flourish. So good leaders allow their teams to really flourish. I hope that all makes sense.
Yeah, it does absolutely. It does absolutely. It all rings very true to the environment and world I live in, for sure. And I think people in every walk of life will understand. I mean, in some degree, in everything everyone does, there's a hierarchy of leadership. So I suppose when we're on the leadership, obviously, your career with Saris, as we mentioned, you know, and quite literally an insane amount of games of rugby played, and the large majority of them in a leadership position. Why,
Sarah? Can I interject then? So remember, when I started playing in 1980, on the fixture list, we would have had 50 to 60 matches in the season.
Well, I'll be honest. I did some quick math there, and I was counting, you know, 460-ish games. I think it was 469, if I'm correct.
I think it's 469, yes.
Right. So
that's
glad
the figure that I've been saying.
Right. Well, let's go with that then. I mean, all you need to do is divide that by 10, roughly 10, and you're looking at, you know, 40 plus games of rugby, which is just berserk. So you must have been going Monday, Wednesday, Saturdays, or there must have been 3 to 4games.
So what we were doing is certainly we were playing every Saturday. There was the odd, at the start of my career, there was the odd midweek game. And then we had Sunday matches. There were times when we would have played Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday.
I'm glad you were scrum half, because if you were a hooker, you were never doing that, let me tell you.
and then on top of that, don't forget the county games, the divisional games, and others. In my last season as a schoolboy, I played 60 matches of rugby and scored 61 tries.
What an amazing example of like robustness, like the ability. I mean, you clearly loved the game, but there must have been times when you were physically tired.
Yeah, there were. But I suppose what helped was I was a PE teacher. And when you're a PE teacher, you're just naturally fit. There were times when I shouldn't have played. Now, I mean, I remember splitting my head open, running off the field, not having an injection, just getting it stitched up, you know, the swathes of bandages, running back on. I shouldn't have gone back on, but we didn't have people and we were checking us, and we didn't have the HRI that you have now. There was another time when I had flu. We were playing Blackheath on New Year's Day. I couldn't run across the pits to warm up. That's how bad the flu was. Somehow I played a full game of rugby and survived. Now, I shouldn't have done that because I could have killed myself.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
But back in the day, we just wanted to play. And of course, when you had, and there was the doctor and the physio, but we overruled them. I'll just say, no, I'm fine. If we could stand up and carry on, I'm saying, yeah, I'm all right, I'm playing. Now, it was wrong. And now I understand. Now, my knees are shot to pieces. My left knee, I've had 8 or 9 operations, 2 major reconstructions. But, you know, my fingers, I've broken most of the fingers on both hands. But I'd love the game and I'd do it all again.
Yeah. I mean, the memories and the opportunities the game gave you are amazing. And I suppose the interesting thing I'd love to touch on is Saracens, because an amazing club. The pedigree that it's held in, it's had a checkered couple of years in relation to the things that it's gone through. But the one thing I always talk about, and we've had a couple of Saris guys come on, is they always talk about the club, that they're looked after at the highest standard. And I wonder, when you take yourself back to the 80s, you know, why Saracens and what was the culture like back then? Because, I mean, I know it's changed hands, etc., but it seems, you know, you still speak very fondly with it.
So why Saracens? In my final year, I was at Borough College, one of the top PE colleges in the country. And before going to college, I was actually a WASP schoolboy. A captain WASP schoolboys played for the WASP. And, you know, and when I was at uni, I was doing some training with the WASPs initially before I went and trained with London Welsh. And that's another story. So I had WASPs that I knew that I could go back to. Harlequins approached me and said, look, you know, we're looking to improve the strength of our squad. You're doing well. Come across to us. And Saracens approached me. So I could choose between Harlequins, the City Slickers, you know, that the aspiring internationals would go to, WASP, that at the time were really developing into a very strong team, and Saracens. And I looked at it now very bluntly. Which of those three teams would I get the most first team games? And it was Saracens, because in my first season, I was up against a scrum half. I think his name was Chris Milford. He was a doctor. He was a houseman. That meant he was only available every other week. Yeah. So every other week, I was playing first team rugby and building up my experiences.
I mean, opportunity. You were looking for opportunity because you obviously believed that you... And I mean, the aim must have been to play for England.
The aim was always, you know, once I'd been a schoolboy and did really well as a schoolboy, my pathway was go to one of the top sports colleges in the country. And the options were Borough Road, Loughborough, St. Luke's, Cardiff, Jordan Hill. And I plumbed for Borough Road, got in there, 3 years there, then played for Saracens, played for my county, which was Middlesex, played for my division, London division, and hopefully all the way through to England. Now here's the rub, and you'll hear me say this a few times. I was always up against it, playing at scrum half, because people had in their mind the black players were out on the wing, centre. They were the strike runners, or they were the big, strong forwards, but they were not ever the scrum half. And I was battling against that. I was battling against selectors that just could not see a black man as scrum half for England. It had never been done, and it just, you know, as far as they were concerned, it wasn't going to happen. So I had to prove, Niall, that I wasn't on a par with these other scrum halves. I had to be so much better. And if I wasn't so much better, I wasn't going to get selected. I got into the Saracens first team. I became Saracens captain. I got into the Middlesex first team, became Middlesex captain, got into the divisional. Well, actually, the division, I was sort of on the fringe. There were a number of times when I felt I should have been the number one scrum half for the London division, but it went to the scrum half from Wasps or Quins. And it's more nuanced and subtle than just saying it's unconscious bias. That is an element, but it's also the fact that Wasps and Quins were the two best teams in London at that time. And they were. Saracens were just beginning to improve. So if you wanted to make the divisional team, the selectors were almost certainly looking at the guys from Wasps and Quins. Is this making sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Did you ever think about leaving to try and, you know, increase the opportunities that you were getting, maybe at Wasps or Quins?
I can tell you now that I had conversations with, I'm prepared to say two of them now, certainly Harlequins, when I was on tour with Middlesex, and some of the Quins boys were trying to talk me into going down to Quins, and I nearly did. The one that's in the book is that we played down at Bath 1 year. We lost, but it was a great game. And I was in the bar with Tony Russ, that was the Saracens coach at the time, and Jack Rowell. Now, Jack, obviously, legend coach at Bath. And we were sitting down having a chat, and Jack turned around to me and said, Floyd, I want you to come to Bath. And I said, you've got Richard Hill. That's scrum half Richard Hill, not flanker. I said, you've got Hilly. He said, I want you at Bath. And I think my response was, look, if you'd have asked me a few years ago, I'd have jumped at the chance. But I'm in my mid-20s, I'm married, I'm settled in London. But when you got Jack Rowell with that star-studded Bath team saying, I want you there, if I'd have moved there, would I have got a cap? Perhaps. But I have no regrets.
No, I don't think you do, because I suppose, would you say it's fair that you've got an amazing legacy at Saris?
I'd like to think so. You know, on a number of levels. You know, it was my team, or I was captain of the team, that got Saris into what is now the Premiership. Mm. You know, when league rugby started, we were literally on the cusp of, were we going to be in the league or not? And I think it was about 1986, 87. We played Met Please, who used to be a very strong team. And the winner was going into the second tier of the national leagues, and the loser obviously drifted. We won that game, so we got into the second division, spent a couple of seasons in the second division before we got promotion. And in my final season, we were one of the favourites to be relegated back down to the second division. And in that last game, we were playing Wasps, and we had a mathematical chance of winning the championship, winning the whole thing. We needed to score a lot of points against Wasps. They beat us. They won, but there were only three teams. That final game, Wasps, Gloucester and Saracens. And no one could believe that there were Saracens still up there in the mix.
Yeah. It's an amazing story. And the club have been, you've already mentioned that you're heading down to one of the Premiership games to sign books. And I think the club's equally as proud of how it's harnessed your story as well. Is that fair?
Yeah, I'd like to think so, because I think deep down, it was incredibly brave of the committee of the time now to say, yes, a black man can play scrum half, and yes, he's good enough to captain the side.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I've always appreciated and applauded them for that, and it was a brave decision.
Very progressive.
As we said earlier, there hasn't been another black scrum half at the top end. And when I was playing, there was definitely not another black captain at the top end of the game.
Yeah, very progressive. And I think that is has to be applauded. I wonder, you know, we've caught, like, I'm not going to lie, I could sit here and talk old rugby with you all day. But I'm conscious that there's this kind of whole other half of your world that we've not covered. And this is the world of education. So you mentioned that you were a trainee PE teacher, you're now obviously a headmaster. I suppose the question is, the first question that springs to my mind is, did you have an interest in going into teaching to try and influence children maybe who haven't had a brilliant start to their lives, to try and work with children at a younger age to influence them, you know, in a really positive way? Or what was the agenda in terms of ending up in there?
So the agenda, when I got to about 13, 14, I knew that I wanted to be a PE teacher. Yeah. A, I seemed to be good at sport. B, my PE teacher, Brian Jones, had saved me, and I really respected him and what he was doing. And I could see that, you know, if you're a teacher, you're never going to be a millionaire now, but it's a comfortable lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And for me, from my background and where I started, that could be stability in what I required. So I knew that I wanted to be a teacher. I knew that I wanted to be a PE teacher. I also knew that I wanted to help children, because when I was in care in the children home, when I became one of the eldest boys in the children home, I would often support the younger boys. And I enjoyed that, gave me a lot of satisfaction doing that as well.
And I suppose the follow-up question is, how many glass ceilings as a black teacher do you feel like you went through? Because your reaction says it all, but I suppose, like, we cover that rugby and there's always a glass ceiling of black scrum half can't lead, can't manage a game. And then as a teacher in your professional life, in inverted commas, how many glass ceilings did you face as a human being there too?
Oh, gosh, I faced the number. I mean, the first one was actually getting a job. You know, you're a young black trainee teacher looking for a job. And again, if you're up against people that are just as good as you, the chances are, because of unconscious bias, you're going to miss out. So you have to prove that you are so much better. If you're not so much better, you won't get a look in. So I knew what I had to do. But secondly, Niall, my first teaching job was with Derek Rosenberg. Now, Derek Rosenberg, a white South African. But you see, I knew his story because he played local rugby for Hendon Rugby Club, and my old boys was all Kings. And you get to know people on the circuit. This white man, Jewish man, his father had meetings with Nelson Mandela. Mm. His parents, they were put under house arrest. So I knew the backstory there. So when he approached me and said, there is a job going at my school, I'd like you to apply. And I applied. And he will say, hand on heart, he chose what he thought to be the best candidate. That's because he didn't see colour. And for that point of view, I was lucky. And that was a break for me. That was a lucky break for me. Yeah. So that was the first sort of ceiling to push through to get the job in the first place. And once you've got the job and you're doing well, you're proving to people that you can move up to the next layer. And I did move up to the next layer. The biggest surprise for me was I spent 10 years in the state sector, 4 at Edgware School and then another 5 at Bishop Douglas, a big Catholic school in North London. Loved my time at those two schools. And then I decided to try my hand in sports marketing, because back in the day, remember, we were amateurs. And because of my rugby, I had a number of people contact me and say, come on, I've got a job for you, Floyd. Do this, do that.
Yeah.
I knew this man that said, rugby is going to become a professional sport. I'm setting up this company and we're going to support rugby clubs and so on. And a number of us thought, yeah, we think he's right. And I worked for this company called Prisma for a year. We made so much money for rugby clubs, amateur rugby clubs, we upset the RFU and they closed us down. And at that point, I thought, well, what do I do? And there was a man that played rugby with me at Saracens, Alex Key. He was captain before me at Saracens, big flanker. And we worked for Prisma together, and we decided we're going to set up our own company, because this is definitely the direction rugby's going in. Just before I agreed with Alex that we're going to partnership, I had a phone call from St. Paul's School, the great public school, St. Paul's. Mm. The high master invited me to have lunch with him and the headmaster of the prep school. And I walked around this school and I had lunch with these two important men. And I think it was over the port, they said, and we want you to be head of sport for our prep school. And that was my interview, having lunch with these two important people. And I thought, this is just too good an opportunity. Even if I did this just for 1 year, I could say I've worked at the great St. Paul's School. And then once I got in and loved what I was doing, but then when you start to sort of look around, you notice that no one else looks like you. I was the very first black teacher this great prep school, private prep school, had ever appointed. So that was another door that I managed to get through. And because of the work that I did with the school, they appointed me onto their senior team. Mm. And then I went for deputy headship, and I went for a number of jobs, interviewed well, but was told that someone with more experience got the job. And when you look at it, then they haven't got more experience. They're just not black, they're white. That's always been the elephant in the room when I was going for senior management and headships. Are the governors, not the teachers, not the parents, not the children, are the governors who appoint the head brave enough to look beyond what they see, a black man, and choose me because of my qualities? And a lot of the time, I'm afraid to say people didn't.
I said, but do you think it's changed? Do we honestly believe that it's changed, or is it changing?
So it's changing. It hasn't changed, but we've moved a long way from where we were. So it's definitely changing. And let me give an example of that now. I'm a governor of two private schools in West London. And I'm delighted to say that both of these private schools, the board of governors, are very diverse. So it's not just white middle-class men anymore. And all schools know that they've really got to focus on diversity, not just within the classroom and within the teaching staff, but also in terms of their governance as well. And they are moving towards that model. You see, things have accelerated because of George Floyd, the tragic, the awful murder of George Floyd, and the Black Lives Matter movement. That's really accelerated things. And what I'm saying to people now, Niall, is that we can't afford anymore just to sit on the fence, as I was saying to you earlier. I mean, I sat on the fence for too many years.
Yeah,
we can't afford to sit on the fence. But I think the important thing now is how are we going to approach these discussions? And I'm finding, because I approach it in a very honest, factual, matter-of-fact way, where I'm not saying I'm the victim, I'm not being aggressive, people listen to me and people buy into that.
What I would say is you're quite dignified in the way you do it. And I suppose what that might frustrate people is that there's no even though it's an emotional topic, there's no emotional response. Do you feel like that's the way for this huge issue to be solved, is for like people to really start to speak with some clarity and some sense on it? Because and I'm not sitting here saying that I understand or I've ever experienced anything like it, but the way you explain it makes it seem like, I mean, all I'm sitting here thinking is what's going on? Why is this still happening? Why are these, someone gets on a bus, Floyd, and there's a black man in a seat, conscious or unconscious. There's a reason that they sit elsewhere. If it's these decisions are happening every single day. And are you pretty confident that the way that we break the mold on these sort of topics is in and around having just really honest conversation?
There's no question about it, Niall, and thank you for your nice comments. But I think that you've got to be, in some ways, slightly detached.
Yeah.
Because if you get too caught up in the emotions, I don't think you're going to put your argument across as well. I think you're possibly going to be seen to being difficult and awkward, and you don't want that. You want people to come with you. You want to win them over. And I've found out in life generally, whether I'm being captain of the Saracens, being headmaster of one of my schools, or talking on these difficult subjects, A, you have to be honest, but you've got to do it in a very calm way where people listen to you and you try to win them over. If there's too much emotion, people are going to be defensive and you're not going to win them over. I hope this is making sense.
No, it absolutely does. It absolutely does. I'm with you the whole way. I wonder, as a younger man, I mean, we're going to start to wrap up pretty soon, and I've got a couple of follow-ups and then kind of some final questions. I wonder, as a younger man, Floyd, were you as measured? Were you as calm? Were you as reasonable about making sure that this is the way that we're going to find the solutions or the path, or have you grown into finding that?
Do you know, Niall, that's a really interesting question. And strangely, I've always been a calm, measured person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the reason why I've managed to be successful.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. It seems very authentic. And I suppose one of the questions I had actually was, because we quite often in life, and I can only speak for myself, is like, people influence me, and I'm a reflection of people through my life. And for me, one of them is my parents. But other than that, I've met people in my life who I've just thought, wow, like, I'd like to be a little bit more like X, or I'm going to borrow a little bit of Y. So in your world, the man you are, the beliefs you have, the things you've achieved, who are the people that have molded you?
In terms of my style of teaching, and that was important when I was a younger man. I've mentioned Derek Rosenberg before, and there was another man that I was like an older brother to me, Gareth James. And I've got to tell you this story now. So when I was at college, well, actually, when I was sixth form at school, this young Welsh female P teacher joined the school, Miss James. And she said that her boyfriend played for London Welsh. And I was just mad keen on rugby. And he took me down to London Welsh, and I met, wait for it, JPR Williams, Gerald Davis, Mervyn Dawes, John Taylor, these phenomenal, you know, all of these British lions, and they were just down-to-earth, really nice guys. And so when I got to college, university, I ditched going back to Wasp to train. I started going down to London Welsh to train. And I was training with these rugby legends. And so I learned so much about rugby from training with these guys. I learned about teaching from Gareth and from Derek. And in terms of just life, I don't know, but I've got to say, the one person who I've always, always admired, and so many people say this, is Nelson Mandela. But one of the main reasons why I admire Nelson, Niall, is because if you think, he was incarcerated in prison for over 27 years. He came out and he should have been an angry, bitter man, but he wasn't. And because he wasn't, look at the progress that that country made. And I worked out, again, I'm talking about being angry and bitter. You're not going to get the result you want if you're angry and bitter and too emotional. So I've tried to be calm and rational. And not all, but much of the time, I've got the results that I want to because of my style of approaching things.
Absolutely. You can see the similarities, you can see the connection there for sure. And I think as a man now who influences young people on a daily basis, has the ability to put some brilliant behaviors and examples for the people like that. Obviously, the well-documented one is Maro. I believe you kind of suggested he pick up rugby whenever he, and I'm sure he's very glad he did. What an amazing human Maro's turned, is developing into with all the work that he's doing. Brave, strong, he's having conversations in realms that rugby players, as we are labeled as idiots or big stupid rugby players, he's having conversations in realms that no rugby player's done before. Are you proud of the kind of progress he's making?
You know, I'm so proud of him. Look, I mean, firstly, he is one of the best rugby players on the planet. And I played a very, very small part, just pointing him in the direction of rugby. And it was a very, very small part.
He could have been playing football, they'd never have got him. So
that's true. That is true. But what I think I'm most proud of is you've got this articulate, intelligent, powerful, in many ways, young man who's actually not afraid to get off the fence. But more importantly, and this is so important, I like his values, I like his character. And that's winning people over. And I hope that I show similar values and character.
Yeah, absolutely. I would completely agree. I would just say I have to be a bit careful about how nice I am about Maro, because on Boxing Day, we're heading down to the Stone X Arena or whatever it's called now for a match.
So it's Stone X, yes.
Yeah. So yeah. It's always very, but I have to say I do agree. It seems like he's developing into someone who's got real you know, kind of character to get off the fence on those decisions. So in but the no, last...
I know you want to wrap up, but I just need to say this. It's very, very important that people understand now sitting on the fence is not an option. If we want to move forward, you don't sit on the fence. Don't be afraid to have the brave conversations. Many people that I speak to now says, we want to have these conversations. We don't know how to start. We don't want to say the wrong things because we don't want to embarrass ourselves and offend people. I say, you won't embarrass yourselves. You won't offend people. If you have the honest conversations and just say at the start, look, I don't mean to say the wrong thing. And I apologize if I do, but that puts others at ease. But you mustn't be afraid to have the conversations.
Agreed. And I think it kind of ties in with the last question in terms of how we round this conversation off. I mean, as I mentioned before, I'm sure you're as uncomfortable with as many compliments as I've given you tonight as I would be, but an amazing story, one that made me feel uncomfortable, one that made me reflect, probably most importantly, one that made me spend some time looking at where I'm from and the things that I've been through. But I think when I flip it to you, when you get, you know, Niall who works in a pub or Niall who's a plumber, what do you want people to really take from the book?
Right. So I want people to take from the book that whatever challenges, and this is the thing, we've all got our challenges. We've all had our challenges. Perhaps mine were extreme, but we've all had our challenges. Whatever the challenges we've got, wherever you are, and you think you're in a really dark place, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There is hope. But don't rely on just other people. You've got to do something yourself. You've got to get off your backside. You've got to believe in yourself. You've got to work hard. And if you can do those things, and I fully admit, Niall, that I did have some luck. You know, I had some people in the background just guiding me in the right direction at crucial moments in my life. But you've got to have self-belief. You mustn't wallow in pity. It's hard. It's a hard, hard world. What are you going to do about it? Say, it worries me, or just pick yourself up, say, well, I'm going to do something with my life. I try to pick myself up and try and do something with my life. So the first message, it's a message of hope. It's a message of belief. It's also a message, I hope, of friendship and family, because of what I went through. One of the most important things in my life is family. And my sons and my wife's family have been the thing that have really kept me strong and kept me going. Yeah. So family. And in this day and age where people say that family is not as important, family is incredibly important. So there are two of the key messages that I want to put across to people.
Well, I have to say, I think you achieved it massively. It's an inspirational story. It's an honor for us to have you on Wind Your Neck In. I mean, it doesn't feel like we sat down just over an hour ago. I could have sat and listened all night, but I think on behalf of everyone who's going to listen to this, a big thank you to you for your time and for your efforts. Thank you for putting yourself out there with some difficult things throughout your life. A Week One Summer, your story, Floyd Steadman, is available now on Amazon. And I would implore people, whether they're sat in hospital waiting for their first child to be born or not, I would implore them to go and give it a read and just really spend some time reflecting on, you know, the things that we have and the things that we can be very grateful for. So Floyd, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much, Niall.